This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a nonprofit healthcare sharing ministry that allows you to control and manage your own healthcare and choose any doctor or hospital in the nation. If you're a freedom-loving American looking for contract-free healthcare, call now 855-585-4237 or go to libertyhealthshare.org.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thank you so much for joining us again. Well, apologetics never goes out of style, but sometimes the information we present as we do apologetics needs an update. And that is the case with a newly updated and expanded version of Josh McDowell's 1972 apologetics classic, Evidence That Demands a Verdict. You probably have it on your shelf like I do. But in this newly expanded version, Josh has teamed up with his son, Sean, to address some of the latest challenges to the Christian faith with some brand new research. And Sean, of course, is an apologetics expert in his own right. He is an assistant professor in Biola University's Christian Apologetics Program and the resident scholar for Summit, California. He joins us now. Sean, great to have you here. How are you?
Janet, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Great. It's great to talk to you again. You know, Evidence was one of the few apologetics books on the historicity of the biblical accounts. This is kind of interesting because this was pointed out in the new edition. And I was thinking about that and I thought, why was it that prior to Evidence That Demands a Verdict, we didn't have a definitive real apologetics book on the historicity of Christianity? This is interesting to me how, you know, we really didn't have a resource like this prior to the time it came out.
I think that's a great question, and my initial thought is that people just didn't have the access to the information. It really wasn't there. We lived in a time where my dad had to travel literally around the world to places in the Middle East, places in Europe, to find quotes and books that weren't even accessible to people. So I think that's why when he put it together, it just was a runaway bestseller because people simply didn't have access to how to even defend the historicity of the Bible and the resurrection.
Yes. Now, this was so interesting. There's an interview with your dad in the book that you did. This is so interesting where he explains what drove him to put together the book in the first place. Can you share a little bit about that? What it was that drove your dad to do all of this research and put it all together in the first place?
Well, the initial part was that he was not a believer, probably more of an agnostic. Lee Strobel is an atheist. I think my father was more of an agnostic. And had some Christian students, he was 20, 21 years old, who challenged him to consider the claims of Christ. And he honestly thought it was a joke. And my dad's always been an entrepreneur, a businessman. And he decided he was going to start traveling around the world with money he had made in other ventures, gather the research, and prove that Christianity was false. That was the whole goal. Well, by the time he started gathering the research, he started to realize, my goodness, this is actually, well, it's actually true. And he became a Christian. So the first part was not to make a case for the Bible. It was the opposite. And then he didn't plan on writing it. He was speaking on the evidences on college campuses around the world as a Christian now. And people kept saying, I wish I had your notes, wish I had your notes. So he put his notes in like a 28-page front and back document, made them like a dollar, and sold thousands of them and instantly thought, my goodness, there's going to be an interest in this. Well, when he proposed the book, no publishers wanted the book. Which is amazing. Then finally a publisher took it and it just became and still is just a runaway bestseller.
I bet those publishers are kicking themselves now. Well, it's true. I mean, that has been an enduring bestseller. And a lot of people probably do ask you, why update it? But I can see the need to update it because we have new challenges that were not so much on the forefront back in the 70s. What would you say are some of these issues, Sean, that you thought and your dad thought were important to update and address?
Well, the internet has really changed everything. My dad wrote it in 72, updated it in 79, updated it in 99. That's almost two decades ago. So the internet has brought so many new popular issues to the forefront. And also scholarship has changed. Like the Old Testament section was on what was called the documentary hypothesis. But that's really not the core issue. So in the Old Testament section, we add chapters on the Exodus. We even deal with a historical Adam. We have chapters on the conquest, some of the big questions being asked today. Now, in the New Testament section, some of the new big questions are like, is Christianity a copycat religion? mean, that was huge with the Da Vinci Code. It was popular in some other, you know, that show Religalist by Bill Maher.
Right.
There's also the new issues of, like, are these, there are these other hidden gospel texts that are supposed to be in the Bible, or there's other gospels that were kept out. There's a lot of issues raised by Bart Ehrman, mm-hmm. so we respond to those. And then I had a chapter on the fate of the apostles. This was my dissertation. But what really happened to the apostles? And no one has really documented this carefully. Were they martyred? What does this mean for the resurrection? And so we added a chapter on that as well.
That's fantastic. Let's talk about that one a little bit, because we just left it there on your dissertation on the fate of the apostles. That has been something I know a lot of Christians, including myself, have wondered about. Well, was it really the case that Peter was crucified upside down, or is that just made up? Or what about Paul being beheaded? That's traditional. Is that really true? What did you discover when you kind of delved into that issue, what the fate was?
Well, there's a few things we know for sure. We know all the apostles were willing to suffer for their belief that Jesus had risen from the grave. We know that from looking at Acts and other extra-biblical sources. We know there's no record that any of them recanted and gave up their faith. But we can't show that they all actually died, I think historically speaking, in the way that it's often taken that we did. I think we can show at least four of them, James, Peter, Paul, and then the other James, the brother of Jesus and son of Zebedee. I think we have good historical evidence they died as martyrs. I think Thomas and Andrew, we can make a decent case for them dying according to the traditional counts. And the rest of them, it's hard to know where history ends and legend begins.
Interesting.
Now, I don't think that disproves the argument, because the argument never showed that the resurrection is true. All it showed is they didn't make it up, they're not liars, and they sincerely believed that. So I think we can make that point. It's just not quite as tight as people have often stated it in the past.
Right. So that account of Peter being crucified upside down, that can be corroborated?
Well, the first record of that is in a book called The Acts of Peter, the End of the Second Century. And that is a book filled with legend, although there is a historical core. And the reason Peter's upside down is not because he says, I'm not worthy to be crucified like Jesus. The reason in that account was because the world is upside down, and when Peter's upside down, he can see it as it actually is, and his death, like Jesus's, will help turn it right side up. So the bottom line is, it's possible he died that way. We know definitely with confidence he died as a martyr. We have early accounts for that, but exactly the means of his martyrdom, it's up for debate. So being crucified upside down, there are accounts people were crucified that way, but I'm a little skeptical that that's how Peter actually died.
That is fascinating. We got to read your dissertation, I guess, to get more and read evidence that demands a verdict again with all the updated information. That's so interesting. What about apologetics in terms of the questions and some of the misconceptions about Christianity that are coming into play right now? We're in a postmodern age. I don't know if we've transitioned into something beyond postmodernism at this point. Sometimes I want to call it just plain insanity. But what would you say are some of the biggest misconceptions that apologists really have to struggle with unbelievers at the moment and skeptics?
Well, I just saw a huge new study on Gen Z, those probably 7 to 22 that came after millennials. Mm-hmm. And the problem of evil is a big question. It always has and always will be. I think issues related to LGBT issues and what identity is are a huge issue the church has to deal with. But also the issue that the new atheists brought to the forefront is still big. Just this idea that Christianity has done damage and great atrocities throughout the history of the world. And I think what's interesting, Janet, is when my dad first wrote Evidence, really the question people were asking is it true? Now, before people even consider if it's true, they're asking the question, is it good? So that's why, is Christianity good? That's why at the beginning we respond to the claim that Christians are hypocrites. We respond to the claim that Christianity's done all these atrocities just by pointing out that when people do those things, they're acting contradictory to what Jesus taught, and that really, in reality, Christianity, although people have done bad things in the name of Christ, has been an overwhelming force for good throughout the history of the world.
Absolutely. Isn't it interesting, that shift between understanding the pursuit of objective truth and how people really understood that that was what you wanted to do in the final analysis, and now turning the tables and saying, is Christianity even good? Almost putting themselves above God. Well, I'm going to judge God. Are you good enough to be my God? It's stunning, the turnaround there and what we're seeing in today's culture. We're going to come back, Sean McDowell with us, talking about the newly updated and expanded version of evidence that demands a verdict. We'll be coming back on Janet Mefford Today right after this.
Here is today's Capitol Hill Brief with Concerned Women for America President Penny Nance.
The founding of Planned Parenthood versus community health centers couldn't be more different. Planned Parenthood was founded under the philosophy that the only way to help the poor was to stop them from reproducing. It's this offensive attitude that led to Planned Parenthood's becoming the largest abortion provider in America. By contrast, community health centers came out of the civil rights movement as a way to reduce poverty and serve minority populations. This model produced tremendous health improvements in these communities and continue to do so today. This is the model for true help and empowerment for those in need, a model Planned Parenthood scorns in favor of abortion on demand.
Join us on the front lines. Fight to defend critical issues like the sanctity of life through prayer and action. Together, we'll bring biblical constitutional values back to our nation. Visit CapitolHillBrief.org to give today. That's CapitolHillBrief.org.
Are you unhappy with some area of your life? Perhaps your job, where you live, your family, or friends? This is Jeannie Niger with Unshaken. I found a key that will change your life. Instead of starting out each day dwelling on what is not right or what I don't like, I choose to pray like this. Thank you, God, for divinely orchestrating every single detail, interaction, and conversation today. Thank you for opening up doors to share my faith. Thank you for enabling me to partner with you to release your plans and purposes today. When my focus shifts from my plans and problems to His plans, life becomes exciting and joyful. I grow in intimacy with God, which enables me to stand strong, regardless of the circumstances. For more on how to remain unshaken in a world that's all shook up, or to download a free chapter of my book, Unshaken, Standing Strong in Uncertain Times, go to jeannienigro.com/Janet. That's jeannienigro.com, JeanneNigro.com/Janet.
To Janet Mefford Today. We're glad you're here and glad to be talking with Sean McDowell, assistant professor in Biola University's Christian Apologetics Program. And he and his father, Josh, have just come out with a newly updated and expanded version of that apologetics classic from 1972, Evidence That Demands a Verdict. Now, before we went to the break, Sean, just to bring people up to speed, you made a really interesting comment, and that is the main question that people were posing back in the 70s when this book was released was, is it true? Is Christianity true? Now they're asking, is Christianity good? What is it that drives that question? How in the world are people starting with a premise that Christianity might be bad?
Well, we used to live in a culture where if somebody was an American, they loved apple pie, they loved baseball, and that person was a Christian.
Right.
That was at least the assumption. Whether they were or not is a separate issue. That, largely speaking, Christianity was in line with at least the proclaimed values of our culture, even though, of course, our culture didn't always live it out.
Right.
Well, I think a couple things have happened. Number one is we become more and more aware of some of the evils done in the name of religion around the world. And there's been an active crusade by the new atheists to really bring to the forefront things like the Crusades, the Inquisition, the sexual priest scandal. And some of these issues have come to the forefront, and people have thought, okay, wait a minute, maybe there's a lot of hypocrisy going on within the church. Even if it's true, I'm not sure I'd want to believe it.
Right.
Second, I also think there's been a massive shift in sexual ethics.
Right.
There really has been. And a lot of this is just the LGBT issues that are in stark contrast with traditional Christianity. And so now, if you really don't praise certain LGBT issues, by definition, you're bigoted, hateful, intolerant, and Talibanic, as one activist personally called me.
That's a new one. I like that.
Oh, gosh.
It's terrible.
That's why studies, some of Barna's recent studies show that if you believe marriage is between one man and one woman for a relationship with life, that is an extremist view.
Oof.
That's an extremist view.
Yeah.
So now there's certain beliefs in our culture that are rubbing up against traditional, classic Christian beliefs. So people not only think it's false, they think it's harmful and damaging throughout the history of the world and in the present, which is why we have to show through our relationships, through our life, and through our stories and our reasoning that not only is Christianity good, but it's true.
That's exactly right, that Christianity is a historical and is a testable faith, as your book points out. Where do you begin in this generation to make the case? And obviously the book is huge and you can go through all the evidence. Where would you begin, though, with somebody who says, I hate Christians, you're all hypocrites, you're anti-gay, you're bigots, you're Talibanic. I got to remember that word because that's so funny to me. How would you how do you begin to talk to that person about the existence of God, the resurrection of Christ, and the centrality of the Bible, all of those things? Where do you even start with someone like that?
You know, my father and I just wrote a 400-plus page book on the evidences, but one of the things we say right at the beginning is these are to be shared in the right way, at the right time, with the right spirit. This
Good.
Is first for Christians to have confidence that this is true.
Good.
So I've had conversations with people that feel that way, and Janet, one of the things my dad and I really try to do is we actually would try to listen. And I'd say, can you tell me your story? Tell me how you've come to those conclusions. What's your experience with Christians? What's your understanding of what God is like? I want to listen to that person, because if somebody's that angry, they're that upset, I almost guarantee you there's either some deep misconception, a broken relationship, or some hurt in their life, and there has to be just some healing first before they'll often even be open to the evidence.
So true.
I just want to spend time answering the questions people are really asking and be ready with an answer. Then if I quickly find out, it's like, no, it's really the evidence. Give me some proof. Let's jump in and talk about it. But I want to err on the side of being gracious. I want to err on the side of listening to somebody's story and just kind of earning the right to share truth, as we do in the book.
Excellent. When we go to the evidence, you have sections on the evidence for the Bible and Jesus and the Old Testament and evidence for truth. When you go to the evidence for Jesus, sometimes I've found that when you cut to the chase and you start talking about Jesus of Nazareth, who was he? What did he claim? Did he really rise from the dead? Those sorts of things. That can almost cut away sometimes, if the person is willing to listen at least, all of the rest of the garbage that people sometimes want to pile into the conversation. In that context, where do you start with Jesus? Do you start with he had to either be, you know, Lord, a liar, or a lunatic? Would you start with the resurrection? How would you begin to present the evidence for Jesus to somebody who really knows nothing about him?
That's such a great question. The first thing I would say first is, who do you understand Jesus to be?
Oh, good.
I want to know, what is this? Because Islam has a view of Jesus, New Age has a view of Jesus. One of the points we make right in the introduction is everybody wants to claim Jesus. Even Buddhists want to say he's an enlightened one. Atheists want to say he's a good moral teacher for the most part.
True.
Except the mythicists who deny that he existed. So I'm going to ask some questions first and just say, what's your understanding of who Jesus is? And then I don't have a formula of where I always go. I just don't. I really try to listen to where the person is at. And I'll probably often say, you know, have you ever thought about Jesus, who has shaped more lives, more governments than anybody else in world history? Nobody who's lived has had a greater influence on the world than Jesus. Have you ever thought seriously about who Jesus claimed to be? Because Jesus said the most important question is, who do you say that I am?
Mm-hmm.
And then I probably just ask the person, who do you think he was? Do you think he existed? Do you think he was really human? Do you think he was God? Could he have been a prophet? And then second, how'd you come to those conclusions? And if I can steer it towards, if the person has theological issues, then I'll take them to John chapter 8 or 10 or Mark chapter 14 and talk about the deity of Christ. If they say, I don't even believe Jesus existed, which I've had people say to me, then I'll take them to the information on the chapter of the existence of Jesus and talk about the positive case there. If they'll say, yeah, maybe he was a prophet, but I don't think he's God, then I'll try to address it accordingly. But it's important, like you said, not to get lost just in the evidences, But oftentimes to just say, you know what, we could debate this stuff, but can I make sure you just understand who Jesus claimed to be in the scriptures? So if you don't believe it, you at least know what you're rejecting. And I've found so many people, when you present it that way, are open to listening to who Jesus claimed to be.
Which is what you want to do. You want people to listen, not to turn around and shun you because they're not interested. You want to draw them in and allow them to consider the evidence for themselves. I think that's terrific. You alluded to something I want to pick up on a little bit when you said that you've spoken to some people who don't believe that Jesus existed. This Christ myth theory, which is, it seems to me, you would know better than I, Sean, but it seems to me this has become more and more popular in the last couple of years. But isn't it the case that the vast majority of scholars give this no credibility whatsoever? I mean, I think it was Bert Ehrman who said, you know, nobody doubts that Jesus existed. So how is this getting any traction?
I think you're right that the vast majority of scholars give it essentially zero credibility. I think the reason it's growing is because of the internet.
Probably, yeah.
People who espouse ideas that are not peer-reviewed, that are rejected by just far more than people say even doubt evolution. You can't even put mythicists and evolution doubters in the same category. For example, there's a website, Descent from Darwin, where there's over 1,000 PhDs in science who doubt the efficacy of natural selection or random mutation. You could count the number of scholars who doubt the existence of Jesus on one hand, maybe two hands. Mm. So it's not even close. I think it's the internet that has popularized this more than anything else,
yeah,
which is why we had a chapter on copycat religion, and we expanded the one on the existence of Jesus, because a lot of people are asking those questions and don't know how to really sift through the evidence.
Right. Theology via the Huffington Post. That's what I like to refer to it as.
Yeah.
I saw an article on it at HuffPo. It's got to be true.
Right.
Yeah. It's crazy stuff. Well, you know, Bart Ehrman is another subject because he is very popular. A lot of people read his books, listen to his lectures. He has a lot of credibility with a lot of people. When you are refuting him, where do you go? Where do you think are the most important points to go in refuting what he has to say about Christianity and where he errs as a skeptic?
Well, I have had people raise issues of Bart Ehrman against Christianity who are Muslims, who are Mormons, and who are atheists. So I think he's the single most influential living atheist on the planet, far more than Richard Dawkins.
Yeah.
So where we go in the end is we just pick some of his big claims and respond to them. So one of the big things he's really popularized is the idea that the Gospels have contradictions and you just can't trust it. So we respond and talk through, okay, what is a contradiction? Here's ways to reconcile these, and just respond to some of them in particular, showing that, number one, even if there was a contradiction, it really wouldn't mean Jesus didn't raise from the dead.
Right.
All Christianity wouldn't come crumbling down if there were one. But second, there's actually really good ways to make sense of these contradictions. So we respond there. Another big one is he's made, as he said in the manuscripts, we answer this one in the chapter 3 on the reliability of the New Testament, is he says there's so many variants, like 300,000 or 400,000 variants across these different ancient manuscripts that we have. In fact, he'll say for every word in the Bible, there's two or three other words that could be there. We can't trust the text. Well, we just break that down and say about 75 or 80% of those are spelling differences. Hmm. The rest of them are words like Jesus is maybe changed to Christ, or he is added for Jesus in different manuscripts. Less than 1% of those variants have anything to do with meaning, and none of those have anything to do with essential doctrine. So Bart Ehrman is a likable guy. He's very smart. He's a first-rate scholar. But he makes some significant mistakes and errors that confuse a lot of Christians and rock their faith. I could tell you stories. I'm sure you've heard them, Janet, of people's faith getting rocked.
Yep.
So by his arguments. So we added an appendix in the back specifically responding to some of his claims.
Oh, that's so helpful. I'm really glad that you and your father have taken the time to update this book, because it's going to help a whole new generation defend the faith with confidence. Evidence That Demands a Verdict, Sean McDowell with us. Sean, always great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Janet, thanks for what you do and for having me on.
God bless you. You are so welcome. We'll be right back on Janet Mefford Today. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a nonprofit healthcare sharing ministry that allows you to control and manage your own healthcare and choose any doctor or hospital in the nation. If you're a freedom-loving American looking for contract-free healthcare, call now 855-585-4237 or go to libertyhealthshare.org. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. How effective is abstinence education? This is an interesting question. There was a study out by the Journal of Adolescent Health arguing that abstinence only until marriage sex education is ineffective. Now, what I found so laughable about this is they quoted on NPR a woman by the name of Laura Lindberg. She's a co-author of the report. She told NPR that it is unrealistic to preach abstinence to kids. It leaves our young people without the information and skills that they need, and we fail our young people when we don't provide them with complete and medically accurate information. Now, ironically, Ms. Lindberg is also a research scientist at the Guttmacher Institute, which is the research arm of Planned Parenthood. So there's a lot to talk about, and we had a great voice for us out there in the NPR story, Penny Nance, president and CEO of Concerned Women for America, and she joins us again now. Hi, Penny.
Hi, great to be on again, Janet.
Great to talk to you. I was so glad to see your voice. The Guttmacher Institute, they keep claiming that they have no affiliation to Planned Parenthood, but for the $2 million that they got a few years ago from Planned Parenthood. There's no affiliation at all, right?
That's right. And, they always are hand in glove with Planned Parenthood. They're spin off from Planned Parenthood. So to somehow pretend that, that they're completely stepped aside from them is just not true.
No.
And listen, I was very pleased to have NPR reach out to me. The reporter really wanted the other side on that story and was specifically looking for a conservative. So I was happy to talk to her about that.
Oh, you were awesome. Well, the report says basically that abstinence until marriage and teaching that is unrealistic. And one of the reasons is due to the older age at which a lot of Americans are getting married. What's your response to that? That we shouldn't be teaching abstinence because people aren't always going along with it? I mean, I don't understand this.
Well, let me just start out by saying, Janet, that there is a variety of studies out there that very much support the idea that abstinence education helps kids. And now we call it risk aversion. Sexual risk aversion. And so that term is usually when you hear that term, it's the other side. But the fact that you are giving good scientific and health information to kids so that they can make the best decision about their future.
Right.
And the idea that, if you're not sexually active in high school, that you're free to think about other things, about your prom or about sports or about your education or achievement. And this idea by the left that our kids are basically animals and have no self-restraint is a self-fulfilling prophecy. And then the final point that I made to her was, the only thing that's 100% effective is abstinence, right? I mean,
yeah.
I have two children, and I only planned one of them, let me tell you. And by the way, I'm not being transparent, I use birth control. So when we're saying to these kids, just make sure that you use a condom and everything's fine, that's just not accurate.
No.
That's not true. And by the way, STDs are a thing. And what about a broken heart?
Absolutely.
What about, an loss of innocence? What about initiation into sexual activity when someone's not emotionally ready for it? So there's a lot of issues aside from our religious views, which are very important, by the way, because there's a large, there's a large number of Christian kids that attend public school, and their parents expect there to be a safe place for them,
right,
in this debate. So, it's important. I was very gratified to get to have the opportunity to talk to NPR about it.
Yeah, it was interesting because they talk about these abstinence only until marriage programs, which accurately explain that the best way to avoid pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases is not to have sex. They also, though, they say, fail teens spectacularly by not divulging critical information about the mechanics and emotions, et cetera, involved in having healthy sexual relationships, leading Laura Lindberg of the Guttmacher Institute to say promoting these programs could constitute a violation of medical ethics.
Oh, give me a break.
I know.
Yeah, and really, like, we don't think that kids in America understand that there is birth control, and that they're, you know, like really that we think that after all this money that's been spent, that it completely, you know, passed them by. They didn't get it. A few years ago, a teen magazine, 17 magazine, did a poll and asked what piece of information that teenagers wanted. And the top thing they wanted to know is how to say no to sexual activity without hurting someone's feelings. That's what they wanted to know.
Yeah.
We have put so much pressure on our kids. We have over-sexualized our children.
Yep.
And we're paying for it.
Yep.
And but, by the way, the good news is, and this is what they will never tell you at Guttmacher, is there is a very large number. In fact, the majority of teenagers are not sexually active,
That's true. Yep.
The numbers tick up when they get to 18, but until at least until 17, it's actually a minority, a vast minority.
Right.
So there's a lot of dishonesty there.
Well, and it's not helped. I think, for example, of that, what was that MTV series, 16 and Pregnant? And you see these sort of things, and then these girls become role models in some respect for some of these girls who say, oh, well, you know, she's got it pretty good. Look at her beautiful baby. I mean, I'm not saying people rush out and get pregnant because they saw a TV show, but it's not like we are just, you know, drowning in media messages of how important it is to wait until you are married to have sex.
No,
I mean, you never hear that.
The missing piece of information, and
yeah.
You never see in a, you know, a sitcom or a reality television show marketed to teens, the champion, the protagonist being the kid that's not sexually active.
Yeah.
It's usually the kids that's acting out. And so, you know, Hollywood has failed us on this. This is why I think more Christians need to go into film and need to go into television and need to go into entertainment.
Yeah.
Because our voice needs to be there, and the kid that's abstinent shouldn't be shown as the kid that's the weirdo. That should be the kid that's
right.
The one that the kid wants to emulate. But we've got work to do. And by the way, one last thing. The money that is spent for abstinence education versus the other form of education, sex education, is minuscule. Like
yeah.
There's always, it's just a very small dollars compared to what CECUS gets, which is the sex education, industry, basically.
Yeah. Well, and the other part of this puzzle is something that I think Abby Johnson, who was formerly a Planned Parenthood worker and now a really strong pro-life worker that you see on TV sometimes and has written a book, she said Planned Parenthood absolutely loves putting kids on birth control precisely because of what you just mentioned, that birth control fails. So, I mean, they have a vested interest. You say here about Guttmacher Institute pro-abortion people like this Laura Lindberg, they have a vested interest in getting kids hooked on birth control and possibly then being able to, you know, move them toward abortion. And isn't in the final analysis, isn't it the responsibility of the older generation to teach what is moral and right and good to the kids and not to give an open platform for Planned Parenthood to earn more blood money? It just riles me.
Well, the education industry and our educational system, public education, has really left an open door to Planned Parenthood and to the left, and we haven't done our own work on this. But, you know, we need to lean in a little bit to the Department of Education and Betsy DeVos and urge that we do a better job of presenting children with the idea that, hey, it's a good idea. It's real and true and good to put your education and put achievement and put your friendships and all of that first and delay sexual activity to marriage. But even if you won't delay it until marriage, you're still better off not being sexually active as a teenager. It's
yes.
not healthy. It's not good for your health.
Yes. Yeah. And I wonder sometimes, Penny, if not for our voices, how will the kids hear? I mean, increasingly,
right.
we're being marginalized as the family's being ripped apart on so many fronts. It needs to be really the important message that Christian parents and mature Christian adults communicate to the kids of the next generation. Hey, you should wait until you get married.
Well, that's right. And that's why, you know, important organizations that are active in public high schools like Young Life and others, and parents that are willing to pour into other people's children that have intact families are so so important, because we do have so much divorce and broken families and broken relationships. The kids are looking for someone. They're looking for an adult that they can look up to and talk to, and we need to be that. We need to be that voice, not just for our own children, but also to other people's kids, and be willing to love them and bring them in and bring them to church with us and make them part of our families for that kid that's looking.
I love it. CapitolHillBrief.org. Check out Penny Nance, the great work of Concerned Women for America. Penny, thank you again for being here.
Thank you. God bless.
God bless you too. We'll be right back.
Did you know that Jesus was Jewish and he's coming back as Jewish? This is Jeannie Nigro with Unshaken. A key to standing strong in these times is having a clear picture of your future with Jesus. And that includes knowing what will be on his heart and what you'll be doing with him. His heart is for the physical and spiritual restoration of Israel. His throne will be in Jerusalem, where he will establish his millennial temple. You'll be ruling and reigning with him there, celebrating all the feasts with him, such as Shabbat, Passover, and Sukkot. The more you have his heart right now for Israel in your prayers, words, giving, and social media, and the more you study and observe the biblical feasts, the stronger you'll be able to stand now and in the future. For more on how to remain unshaken in a world that's all shook up, or to download a free chapter of my book, Unshaken, Standing Strong in Uncertain Times, go to jeannienigro.com/Janet. That's jeannienigro.com, JeannieNigro.com/Janet.
Many people in developing nations have no access to desperately needed medical care. That's why Mercy Ships brings volunteers aboard our hospital ship, the Africa Mercy, to give the world's forgotten poor the free medical care they need. We have an immediate need for registered nurses, especially with a pediatric specialty. As a volunteer nurse, you won't just give life-altering health care. You'll receive so much in return.
It's an amazingly rewarding experience.
You'll give hope and make a difference in the lives of those who have virtually no access to medical aid.
It's such a fantastic thing to do. Everybody who I've met on this ship either wants to come back and do it again, or they're already here for the second, third, or tenth time.
So what are you waiting for? Show mercy to someone today.
I would say go for it.
Get more information and learn how to apply by visiting mercyships.org/nurses. That's mercyships.org/nurses.
We are back on Janet Mefford today. Can you believe that we have a judicial nominee who is in trouble with the left for being religious? No, I don't think you're surprised. One whit, neither am I. We remember very well Bernie Sanders grilling Russell Vogt just a few months ago now, and getting on him because of an article that he wrote and talking about Muslims standing condemned in their sins because they don't trust Jesus Christ, and Bernie Sanders went all nuts. You'll remember that. Well, now we have more leftists going after somebody because of her faith, and this is the case with Dianne Feinstein, the senator from California. She was part of this crew that was querying Amy Coney Barrett, Trump's nominee to the Seventh Circuit. She co-wrote a law review article 2 decades ago, and she was arguing that in some cases, a Roman Catholic judge who conscientiously objects to capital punishment should actually recuse herself rather than enter an order of execution against a convict. So she's against capital punishment. Now, you would think the left would go nuts and go, this is great. This is fantastic. Fabulous. Let's just rubber stamp her. But apparently she's just too religious. This is what Senator Feinstein had to say. Cut one.
When you read your speeches, the conclusion one draws is that the dogma lives loudly within you. And that's of concern when you come to big issues that large numbers of people have fought for years in this country.
That would be abortion. I mean, you kind of have to read between the lines here, but clearly what she's saying is that if this woman would recuse herself over capital punishment, she might recuse herself over abortion. And we can't have that. I mean, that's obviously what she's referring to. But even worse was Illinois Senator Dick Durbin. This just really takes the cake. I like to call it the reverse Spanish Inquisition, and you're going to find out why that is. This is cut two.
It is relevant in that you have many times spoken out as a professor and as a lawyer about the burden and opportunity presented by your faith. This article of 20 years ago, which you wrote with John Garvey, as I understand it, you now say you don't agree with. Is that correct?
No, Senator Durbin. I agree with the article's main point, as I said, which is that any kind of conviction, religious or otherwise, should never surpass the law. A judge can never follow or impose that judge's personal conviction upon litigants in the decision of cases. And that was the article's main point, and I agree with it. Would I, sitting here today, write that article the same way or say that it's an exact mirror image of how I would feel now, 20 years older? No. I mean, but at the thrust of it, that core point, which restates 28 U.S.C. 455's ethical obligation, I obviously, as every judge would, adhere to.
Why in the world would an argument over the ability of a justice to recuse herself when she has a conflict of interest be a matter of concern for Dick Durbin? Because that's the ethical thing to do. Would that you had Sonia Sotomayor, or I should say Elena Kagan, recuse herself on the Obamacare case. But that's not what they do on the left. So recusal is a problem. Recusal is actually a very ethical thing to do if you're making the judgment that you can't be fair and impartial. So what's the issue? Well, the issue is her Catholicism. Now, this is hilarious when you listen to this. Dick Durbin just really reveals his own ignorance when he queries her in this instance. Listen to cut three.
So let me ask you this question. I'm a product of 19 years of Catholic education, and every once in a while, Holy Mother, the Church has not agreed with a vote of mine and has let me know. You use a term in that article, or you both use a term in that article I'd never seen before. You refer to Orthodox Catholics. What's an Orthodox Catholic?
As I recall, that term, we said something like, for lack of a better term, we're using the term Orthodox Catholic, and there was a long footnote saying, you know, that was an imperfect term. It could, you know, refer to Orthodox Judaism, you know, Greek Orthodox. And so we kind of cast about, but what that term was designed to capture, because we were talking about conscientious objection, was a judge who accepted the church's teaching that the death penalty would be impermissible in that case. We wrote about it from the perspective of a Catholic judge because my professor, John Garvey, had already undertaken that project, but it's really a problem that could face a judge of any religion or no religion at all who had a conscientious objection to the death penalty.
All right, now listen to what he says in the final cut. This is cut four.
Do you consider yourself an Orthodox Catholic?
I am a Catholic, Senator Durbin. I don't, Orthodox Catholic, we kind of, as I said in that article, we just kind of use that as a proxy. It is not, to my knowledge, you know, a term currently in use. But if you're asking whether I take my faith seriously and I'm a faithful Catholic, I am, although I would stress that my personal church affiliation or my religious belief would not bear on the discharge of my duties as a judge.
There are many people who might characterize themselves as Orthodox Catholics who now question whether Pope Francis is an Orthodox Catholic. I happen to think he's a pretty good Catholic.
I agree with you.
Good. Then that's good common ground for us to start with.
Okay. Let's just go through this a little bit, line by line, not line by line, through the quotes there from the cut. But first of all, neither Dick Durbin nor Dianne Feinstein have any credibility in morally judging anybody. I'm sorry, but look at their track record. Look at their track records on abortion and on so many different issues. And for Dick Durbin to be grandstanding as some sort of moral authority and I will decide what is right and wrong, it just turns my stomach. I'm sorry to say that, but it really aggravates me. Who does he think he is? And he had 19 years of Catholic education, but he's never heard the term Orthodox Catholic. How is that even possible? Here's a little hint, Senator Durbin. Orthodox means correct. And what it means is that when you put that word in front of the noun, whatever the religion has to be, all it means is the person who is orthodox to the religion listed after that word. In other words, they believe what the religion actually is. They are not cafeteria Catholics, for example, just like Orthodox Jews. They are very faithful to the Torah. And so they're correct. They are correct in their theology insofar as Judaism would be considered by them to be Orthodox theology, but you get the principle. All it means is I'm actually a Catholic, or I'm actually a Jew, or what have you. How in the world do you get to be his age in that position and not know something so basic when you're Catholic? I'm not really sure how that works. And here's the bigger point. When he asks her the question, do you consider yourself an Orthodox Catholic? I think that that question is out of bounds, because that's a religious litmus test. You know, say it any way you want. How in the world is that an appropriate question for a judicial nominee? Can you imagine if that was a woman sitting there in a burqa? Do you consider yourself an Orthodox Muslim? I mean, oh my word, CARE would go nuts. There'd be press conferences from sea to shining sea. Oh, Islamophobia. Where's the outcry here? And I felt very sorry for this woman having to sit there and endure that kind of assault. It really was the reverse Spanish Inquisition. That's what I think. Because here we have the contrast on what went down in the 15th century, and people were convicted of crimes and they were executed if they were found to be less than Orthodox Catholics. What is this but the reversal? And I'm not saying anybody's going to be burned at the stake here. I'm not insinuating that executions are imminent for this judicial nominee, but it's shameful and they ought to be called out for it. And I'm glad that so many people are calling them out for it. Here's the interesting thing. John Garvey, with whom this judicial nominee wrote the article 20 years ago, has a piece in the Washington Examiner and says, I never thought I'd see the day when a coalition of left-wing groups attacked a Republican judicial nominee for opposing the death penalty. He said, in the article we wrote, we argued that the death penalty was immoral, as the Catholic Church teaches, in common with Quakers, Episcopalians, Presbyterians, Methodists, and the 38 member communions in the National Council of Churches, i.e. the liberals. We went on to say that a Catholic judge who held that view might in rare cases have to recuse herself. That is a federal statute, and he lists the number of it, that asks a federal judge to step aside when she has conscientious scruples that prevent her from deciding a case in conformity with the facts and the law. Catholic judges are not alone in facing such dilemmas, and that's one of the reasons we have a federal recusal statute. What's so stunning here, as he mentions, is that Professor Barrett has asserted that judges should not follow the law or the Constitution, according to this Alliance for Justice website. This is crazy. This Alliance for Justice is saying that Barrett thinks that judges shouldn't follow the law or the Constitution when it conflicts with her personal religious beliefs. She actually argued the opposite. And this is something that John Garvey points out. This is the president of the Catholic University of America. He says, at the end, I suspect what really troubled them was that as a Catholic, her pro-life views might extend beyond criminal defendants to the unborn. If true, the focus on our law review article is all the more puzzling. After all, our point was that judges should respect the law, even laws they disagree with. This is where we are. The left gets to apply religious litmus tests and impose inquisitions. And that's perfectly fine, because apparently secularism as a religion rules all. Incredible. Well, we thank you for tuning in, and we will see you next time here on Janet Mefford Today. God bless.